Well, hello again, and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all our interviews by going to our website at www.authorsaudio.com and listen to all the interviews there by clicking on the listen icon on the home page. Today I have with me a poet of great renown. His name is Jack Marshall, born in 1936 in Brooklyn, New York, and is an award-winning American poet and author, born to an Iraqi father and a Syrian mother of Jewish heritage. He was awarded the Penn West Award and was also a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle Award for his novel From Baghdad to Brooklyn. He was awarded recently a Guggenheim Fellowship for his work of selected poems called Gorgeous Chaos in 2008. He is also the author of 12 other books of poetry, the latest called The Steel Veil. I welcome Jack Marshall to Authors Audio.
Yeah, I didn't submit any prose to the Guggenheim. It was on the basis of the poetry.
I'd like to start off a little bit with just a little bit of history and talk about your early life in Brooklyn. I know that your father was from Iraq. He emigrated to England, and then eventually you came to America, to New York. And your mother was actually Syrian. Was she Jewish?
Yes, both Jewish. It confuses people when I tell them my parents were Arabic Jews. It sounds like an oxymoron today. Both Jewish, both Arabic-speaking Jews, Sephardic Jews is what they're called. They were the Levantine Jews after the expulsion from Spain in 1492. Those Jews went to North Africa, the Mediterranean, and settled there. And the other Jews went to Europe, the Ashkenazic Jews. So actually, my father came during the Depression to America. I was born here in New York, in Brooklyn, but both my parents immigrated to America.
Now, tell me, how did your early life in Brooklyn, it must have affected you and your ideas and your thinking and your writing. Maybe you could tell me a little bit, a small story of your life there and what inspired you and what affected you in your life there.
Okay, well, I grew up in a house where there were no English language books. Because both my parents spoke Arabic in the house and had only religious prayer books in the house, so in school I came across Shakespeare, Keats, Shelley when I was in junior high school, and I became interested curious, and then I discovered the public library, which was a mystery to me, but I didn't know about it until I saw a friend walking down the street with an armful of books, and I asked him where he got them from, and he told me. So I became a regular visitor to the library, and in any case, my interest in poetry grew on its own, I think. I just became fascinated. I think Shakespeare was the first poet really excited me, because I saw what he was doing with the line, and he packed so much intensity and perception in the line that it became kind of exhilarating, and I wanted to be part of that company, part of that magic, as I saw it, and I just wrote, and when I got out of high school, I really did not want to go further into college, because I pretty much knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to write and travel, so that's how I so sort of. I was writing at the age of 14, and then I continued with whatever job I was working at for a living. I continued to write, and when I came back from Africa, I seriously decided that that's what I wanted to do. Bar anything else.
Yeah, you were 19 and you traveled to Africa as a seaman.
Yeah, yes, yeah. I worked on a Norwegian freighter, and Africa was really quite an altering experience. It was another planet. It was nothing. Americans don't really understand what they don't realize how privileged we are living here. The rest of the planet is really, in at least that part of the world, is so deprived, is so elemental, that I came back in shock. I think for several months I couldn't get over what I had experienced. And my first book came out of poems written about Africa and also New York, and it was called The Darkest Continent.
Well, the beautiful thing about someone who has a little inspiration and has the sensitivity to pick up on what's going on around them can really bring back a compacted version, I would think, of their experience that a lot of people perhaps just don't have that gift, and that is one of your gifts.
Well, you know, my feeling is in writing that when it's published, because I'm not aware of it when I'm writing, but when it's published, it really is a sharing of somebody else's solitude of being alone. But you're sharing it. If people respond, that's great. But you're trying to do something for yourself. You're trying to nail down precise perceptions and feelings and observations. That's essentially how I see what I'm trying to do, is to trying to get the details right, whatever it is.
Right. Did New York itself, as you were growing up, did that have any particular influence on your writing that you feel today?
You know, I had friends there. I met older poets there, Robert Lowell, Stanley Kunitz. I suppose the beats were the sound, the verbal energy of the beats was in the air. So I suppose I'm the last one to be able to answer that question, but my sense is it would have to have influenced me, because I did write about it. There are poems and also in the memoir From Baghdad to Brooklyn, there's a lot about my experience living in New York and working in New York, especially working in Manhattan when I was, I'd get out of school and then go down to the city and work in the garment center at a job, various jobs, kinds of jobs, just garment center kind of jobs,
Anything at all to make a dollar to continue on, of course.
Well, I was living at home still before I went to Africa. I was living at home, so I would work and basically to help support my family. When I came back from Africa, that's when I started living on my own. Actually, before that, I traveled for a while in the Midwest and the South, just taking odd jobs, and that experience was also very very interesting. I saw what the rest of the country, or different parts of the country, were like, and they were like different countries. The South really is a different country. The southern states are really another time, never mind another country.
Yeah, you find this out if you're a traveler, which you are.
Yeah.
I know. I was down visiting South America, Brazil and Argentina, Bolivia, a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago now. And, you know, that was such an eye-opener to me. Not that they don't have electricity or they don't have many, many things we have, but the tone of life, the pace of life, and how people can extract beauty from life is so much different there than it is in the world that you and I are living in here in North America.
Yeah, I guess that's what we mean by culture, calling it culture. Because it really is a biological, you know, you can feel it in the air, on the TV, the radio. It's all a culture. It's something, it's a sort of a biological entity that we live in, and we're just parts of it and interrelated, and we have our own sense of time. Each culture has its own sense of the value of time, and that has a lot to do with how we respond, respond to things. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. When did you sort of decide to move to the West Coast? Was that quite a while ago? And was there any attraction for you there other than the weather?
Well, yeah. You know, I had come out here to get married in the early 1960. And my wife's family lived in Southern California, and I passed through San Francisco, and I liked it very much. And then we went back to New York, and we lived on the Lower East Side for about 8 years. And the Lower East Side started to get very threatening. There was a lot of gangs. There was a lot of drugs coming onto the street, and people were getting mugged right in our hallways. So we had a new baby, so we decided we would move to San Francisco, which we had liked. And we just picked up and came out here in 1968. And so the weather is just a bonus. But I haven't looked back. I don't really miss New York, although for somebody who's never been or lived there, it'd probably be a good thing.
Well, I think you got there for the summer of love then, didn't you?
We were here, yeah. There was a lot of changes going on, yeah. I think that the difference between New York, the East Coast, let me put it that way, and the West Coast, at least for my sense of the poetry where it would be reflected, is the East Coast, I feel, you know, crowded, at least New York, crowded, crammed, noisy, and the West Coast is much more spacious. So there's a lot more air in the poems, I think, from New York to the ones I've written since being in California. I think there's a lot more space and air between things, between images. You know. Anyway, that's my sense of how I feel out here.
Other poets and writers, I can know of a few. Of course, the beats. Some of the beats came from New York and went out west, but certainly Charles Bukowski had a long haul of trying to get published, and finally, of course, did. John Fonte, an excellent writer, had quite a hard time, I think. Well, he actually went into screenplay writing, so that's where he made a lot of his cash, and the book writing sort of, that he could subsidize his book writing.
I never looked on my writing as a way of making a living. So I was sort of liberated from that concern, because I always worked at other jobs, and I didn't expect to live off my writing. It would be foolish, really ridiculous to expect that. I wasn't really a dedicated prose writer, so I couldn't count on that. No, I knew that the poetry wasn't going to support me and my family. But so I was free in a way. I felt very liberated. I didn't have to count on it for teaching jobs or anything like that, or lectureships or anything. So it was a great freedom to feel that.
What was the main thing that you did do then to support yourself through the years to give you this kind of freedom?
Well, lots of different jobs. I worked as I worked in several factories. I worked as a advertising copywriter. I worked in a steel mill. I worked in the garment center in New York. I worked here as a longshoreman in San Francisco when I first got here. I ran a clothing shop in San Francisco for a while, and then I got invited by George Starbuck, who ran the Writers' Workshop at Iowa, University of Iowa, to come teach there after The Darkest Continent came out, and somebody gave it to him, gave him a copy at a party, and he called me and asked me if I'd like to teach there. So I taught there for a couple of years, and then I taught at San Diego, in San Diego, at a university there for a year or so, and then I stayed there after that teaching job ended. I just stayed on for a while, living with a bunch of people in a sort of a commune. And then came back, after a couple of years, came back to San Francisco, and I worked at the UC Medical Center. I was the assistant, a man there who had been the chief of medicine for 25 years. And I was his assistant. So it's many different kinds of jobs. There's no one particular thing. I just, I did what what came to, I did some house painting, whatever came to hand, you know?
Yeah. The story of your working life reminds me of myself. Really, to be honest with you. Yeah. But that is, in a strange way, that is a gift to a poet or a writer, because there are so many things you learn from taking on all sorts of different things that you weren't necessarily particularly interested in, but
even when you don't want to.
Especially when you don't want to.
Right. Those are the lessons that last the longest, probably.
And I get that in your writing, that there's a wealth there, and this is I'm just sort of speaking to my listeners, and I'm thinking, you know, by listening to you and your story, there's a lot of writers out there, you know, new writers, whatever, and most writers, of course, have to support themselves by doing other things. Painters have to do the same thing, whatever. Artists in general. Sometimes we forget that we're out there doing research, and we're kind of getting paid for it in a way.
Well, that's the optimist viewpoint. I never saw it that way. Yeah. No, but I never. I don't feel that an artist is owed a living from the state. You know, to really be, one has to be subversive in one's work. So how can you expect to be supported by the state or by some other entities? If it comes along, that's fine. But to expect it, to assume that it's one's right just by calling oneself a poet or an artist, I think is a big mistake. And we're very foolhardy. Anyway.
We have in Canada here, Jack, something called the Canada Council, which is a grant system for artists. There are a lot of, I would call, we've had some really wonderful people that have been helped by that. And we've had a lot of people who, quite honestly, in my idea, didn't really don't know what they're doing at all. So you're absolutely correct, is that a grant now and again can really be helpful to the right person, and it can free them up and get them going, but many times these things can be abused also.
Yeah, it's hit or miss. It's a crapshoot, really. Anyway, I'm not trying to, spread blame anyone, but I should be the last one to talk. I just received Guggenheim, and it's a great help. But I'm more than 70 years old, so it's.
Oh, you're just getting started, Jack.
Yeah, right.
But I mean that in almost a serious way. Don't you feel that, you know, in some ways, it's like the fine point of the pencil is just coming, as you get a little older, you know a little bit more about what to leave in and what to put in, what to leave out.
I think that's true. You have a good point there. As I get older, I what I find is that I want things to be sparer, and more so, even if more so than before. And that's because each word has more weight. I mean, as one gets older, you know, you feel the weight of your body, and the work has to reflect that sense, both weightiness of, you know, physical weightiness, but also things that you have to contend with. There's no point in wasting words and time by putting in. You want the work to be barer, and just saying, just pure statement, almost bare, pure statement. And that's what I would like to do. Actually, with each book, I feel like I've sort of finished something. And I don't want to look back at them. I can't look back at it and read, because I would not only probably disagree with certain things, but I'd want to rewrite and revise certain things. So I try not to look back, so the new work, it has to come into the new work when you feel it.
Well, I'd be very interested to know, Jack, who are the writers that have influenced you in your writing career?
I think of the Americans, Walt Whitman and Hart Crane. You know, one poet, your interest in one poet will lead you to not only one, but several, and then you get this sort of great spreading out of interest and reading that you find yourself doing. But I would say Whitman, Hart Crane, Robert Lowell, Dylan Thomas was a, I loved hearing that voice. In fact, I think it was a teacher, high school, in junior high school, reading Dylan Thomas' poem. He was so ecstatic in reading it. He was enjoying it so much that it was the first time I'd ever seen a teacher actually relish what they were reading, you know, physically relish what he was reading. I could see why, too. The music and the imagery was so luscious and captivating that I immediately went and got the Caveman record of Dylan Thomas and read his work and all. And even when I didn't understand a lot of it, I loved the imagery and the music. And, it's sort of like when you create a language, you create a kind of a form of life. An alternate life sometimes, and it's thrilling at its best. It's exciting.
What about the Spanish poets?
Oh yeah, sure. I think probably like everyone, García Lorca. I especially liked his poet in New York. Those mad surreal poems he wrote in New York. They were just were like hot lava flowing, through the. Through the pages, the imagery was so molten that they were kind of ecstatic. Even when he was expressing horrible, terrible things that he saw, they were exciting in the way he wrote about them. Neruda came probably later, and then Vallejo, and I like Jose Jimenez.
Jimenez, Ramon Jimenez, just a marvelous poet and very deceptively simple, but the words and the lines are just so perfectly laid down. Just he's a real master, I find. Yes.
Yeah, I like him for his tightness and he's almost like a barbed. I liked his spareness, contrasted to someone like Neruda, who is much more luscious the list goes on. Mandelstam and Pasternak and Tsvetaeva of the Russians, R.S. Thomas, a Welsh poet, who died just some years ago, who was a contemporary of Dylan Thomas, but was hardly known at all. And I discovered him late myself, long after I was enamored of Dylan Thomas. I can mention a few contemporary poets who I think are really very worthwhile. There's Steve Cowick. He lives down in Southern California. There's Morton Marcus, also in Southern California. There's Dennis Schmitz, who lives up here in Northern California. People both know about Robert Hass. Literally, if one starts, reading, they will be led to other authors. It's a chain reaction when you're sort of handed over from one poet to another.
Yeah, it's a long road. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long right. Exactly. Yeah.
Very soon, I'm going to ask you if you would like to read some of your work, but I wanted to ask you if you mind telling us, how do you work? Do you write every day, or do you have little tricks to use if you get a writer's block, or anything pertaining to your work habits that maybe some writers would be interested in knowing how you work?
Well, what I've always done from the very beginning, almost automatically, is to have a notebook, which I jot things down in, and I will often have a smaller notebook that I carry around with me just to jot things down. Things I'll hear on the grocery line in a store, or waiting for a bus or something, or a sign I see in the street, or I've been really, really fascinated by things that you see by chance. You see or hear people say, or slogans you see on the wall, and I'll just jot those down and carry it with me. And then I have a notebook at home that I'll have lines that just come not even a line, just a phrase or an image or something. And I don't know what would connect them, but they interest me in the moment, and I just jot them down. And the act of jotting them down, I think, helps, because I will come back to these things later and work from often from fragments. I'll have a first line that will interest me, and then that line will sort of want an answer or a response, and to find another line. And you find yourself working on all levels at once. It's sort of like writing music, I suppose, writing more than one instrument.
Well, Jack, I think you're you and a lot of great artists are really alchemists. It's an alchemy at work here, because you're taking disparate ideas. Picture there, a word here, a feeling there, and somehow sitting down you have a special way of connecting these into a basic central idea that works in your field, which is in a poem.
Well, I see it as a wanting to make something, wanting to make a sound, wanting to make a statement, to articulate something clearly. You may not know what it is at first, but you're nagged not so much nagged, but intrigued, fascinated. That curiosity has to be a driving force. And things come together when they need to. Things like each other will associate with each other, and you have a kind of a motor, an energy that's moving, and you want to follow to see where it goes. And sometimes you'll find yourself saying things that you would rather not say, or would like to have said, but it has to feed the poem. The poem has to interrogate itself as it moves. It has to be honest, true to it. You're trying to find a cadence that's convincing, you know, first to you and then to the reader. And, you know, you're surprised, you know, you have to be surprised. You don't know this beforehand. So it's not like expressing your life. It's really discovering something you didn't know before. You had no idea. And you could be expressing the worst, you know, the terrors, you know, the Greek tragedies. But if the language is formed in such a way that it's true, there's some kind of joy in that. It's a dark joy, but it's still a kind of joy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if you would give our listeners a chance to hear you read a few things from your works. I know you've published 12 books of poems. You also have your Brooklyn to Baghdad book and your latest book, The Steel Veil, which is a wonderful poetry book with 55 poems. Beautiful, beautifully done.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Coffee House does terrific. They've been constantly fair and published my last, I think, 5 or 6 books. Yeah. I can read a poem early in the book in The Steel Veil. The title of the poem is "In This Ring of Boundless Ripples." Light as our green-eyed cats step on the new spring grass, morning air stirs, variously scented, no breeze but with a flower's fragrance passes, as does the wailing sound heading into summer of the freight train approaching, then passing, which may have wailed as well in winter, but closed down, I hadn't listened. Paying attention is the hardest payment to make. Each day I am living proof that on the streets of little tenderness, thronged as causeways to cemeteries waiting for the clinching detail in a driven, fissured world, we value nothing so much as what we are about to lose that we grasp at the last. I know such testaments of the aged. Asphodel, Four Quartets, The Rock, Hardy, Jeffers, Oppen, that flower near the end, for us might be any day now. Whether we've been mean or merciful, rain has been pumping the blackberries into plump, succulent clusters beneath their sheen of powdery dust. To make that last awareness day's first and not forget the berries' blueness beneath their dust, the dress of rose petals spread on the ground, your headlamp in the garden at night, a miner's high-beamed eye tracking aphids and snails down with plucked precision. The gardener's green thumb, outdone by your green arm, often running red from thorns you'd almost give CPR to revive. Roses are forgiving, you say, but to me they're pitiless as the claws of our cats I call ungrateful, especially the feral tabby I rescued who couldn't care less when you comb, clip, and groom them in fierce, focused embrace. I have cut back the strangling nightshade vines for now. In the infinite ring of boundless ripples, there are places with more of what there is of here. We have worked to make the boundless near, have chosen this ring to live in, that the fist of each self unclench, to make of noon a shaded garden and evening shelter.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you, Jack.
I have a short one. It's actually the next poem in the book. It's called Courtesy. It's a small thing, but I kind of like it. It's Courtesy. The blind man I help onto the bus tells me, I took the bus to see my mother. She doesn't get out much. We watched football on TV. I note he keeps his ones and fives in different pockets of his wallet as he fingers them to pay the fare. I glance out the window. It looks like rain, I say. We cross a bridge. Fog hazes. A lighthouse beams in the distance. At my stop, I get up to leave. See you later, he says, facing straight ahead. And I sense it as a courtesy, his speaking my language of saying more than we can see.
And these are from Jack's new poetry book just out, The Steel Veil, published by Coffee House Press. And did you have anything more you'd like to read, Jack, or?
Okay, I'll read one from near the end. It's called The Buddha Sends His Regrets. Part the curtains, and the light pours in. March wind's bright brusqueness gust away whatever was burnt today or long discarded. The rust-needled Christmas tree lying a hulk of flaking fishbone by the fence. The dust glitters, but not for long. Though the old year's losses fade and how today feels, all that lives in the world we call ours are born of molecules in motion to leave it. This garden and grief to haul it away. That's all you can say about the visible. It vanishes in a sky vast and empty as before there ever was grief, or an eye to cry it. Here, where the West comes to rest, the Buddha sends his regrets, weighing no more than a feather blows from a wing, light as the silence that waits, can wait forever, to wither the voice that lies and hides, and does to the mind what time does to a face.
Very interesting line. I like that line. The voice that lies and hides and does to the mind what time does to a face. That's staring it right down the middle.
Yeah.
You know, I love your work, Jack, and I'm so happy that you've been able to spend some time with us today on Authors Audio, and we will be having more poets as well.
Thank you for asking me to take part in your program. I enjoyed it. You're welcome, and thank you, Jake.
Well, once again, Jack, I really want to warmly thank you for taking the time to be with us today on Authors Audio and reading some of your very, very beautiful poems from your latest poetry book called The Steel Veil, which will be available through Amazon on my website, worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com, and is published by Coffee House Press. So until next time, this is Jake D. Steele saying keep dreaming and happy reading. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.